Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prisoners will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economic. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 or 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folks got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with your politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about something like about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. And you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisoners in the United States are black people. You know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, boy, who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
We'll be right back.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank a three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No. Nope.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Because I used to observe that a lot of those shacks used to be by the track where black people were.
With the room in the back.
Yes, with the room in the back. That was a safety net.
Yeah.
Where black people who would move here and there and go from here and there looking for jobs, that's usually why we move, and the jobs would play out like they always did.
And do.
But we had a place to go when the sun went down. But now, those shacks by the track don't exist anymore. They came and built highways right alongside of those railroad tracks where those shacks used to be. Super highways. So now, if you get on a highway, you might notice that sometimes you're right alongside of a railroad track. You see trains passing
that
as you're driving.
That is true.
Down a superhighway.
Mm-hmm.
Well, see, those highways used not to be there in the northwestern hemisphere. It used to be shacks along there. A lot of those shacks were on what we call railroad property. But the railroad people, the people that ran the railroads, didn't care much because nobody wanted to be down. That wasn't prime real estate.
No.
Nobody wanted to be by the tracks anyway. So black people used to build those shacks around there back when black people knew how to build shacks. Black people don't know how to build anything now because they used to build places for white people, but they cut them off with things called unions, took the carpentry all out of the schools and all like that. So how many black people do you know that know how to fix anything now? It used to be thousands and millions of black people that know how to build a house from scratch out of old pieces of lumber.
Wow.
A lot of people don't remember that. Most people are not that old to have seen it done.
Hmm.
I started coming along. I'm old enough to remember when many black people used to get together on a Saturday afternoon. That was the only time they had off, or sometimes, or on a Sunday sometimes after church. They would get together, six or eight of them, and go down and build what they call a shotgun house. It wasn't much, but it was a roof over your head, a good solid roof. I've been in some of those houses, raised up in some, all right? They were excellent, solid houses. They could stand a lot of storm and rain. They weren't much, just maybe three rooms. But I've been in some of them. And there were many, 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 many of them. But along came the white supremacists and say, these Negroes know how to build stuff. We're going to fix that so the next generation won't know how to do anything except stand in front of a place that is built and beg, because they won't know anything about carpentry or masonry or how to make anything with their hands.
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you're having is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go over on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it's on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad, Cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit, and it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come. I used to spend the night in hotel parking lots. What was I going to do? I ain't had nowhere to stay, so I lived in the car. I had $35. And I said, come on, God, man, I've been trying to make this dream come true. You done left me out here like this. And I was crying so hard that he just said, I didn't like hear a voice or nothing. But he spoke to me, and however he said, if you get up, I'm going to take you places you ain't never been. Now, I was finna quit. So I said, skip it. I'm going to quit anyway. So I got my car. I went to a payphone, and I was going to call my dad. You remember back in the day where you could punch in a code and call your answering machine and get your messages? So I called, and I punched in the code, and he said, doop. He said, hey, Steve, this is Chuck Sutton with Showtime at the Apollo. We saw a tape of you. You're very funny. If you could get here Sunday night, we'd love to put you on television. Call me back. Let me know if you can make it. So I hung the phone up. I'm crushed because my whole dream of being on TV, and I couldn't get to New York. I got $35. How am I going to get to New York? I can't make it. So I'm standing there at the phone booth and tears just coming down my face. I said, God, so that must be a sign for me to go home. Because this it. I ain't even got the money to go to the Apollo. My whole thing, I wanted to be on TV. I couldn't even make the dream come true. This is the most messed up moment. And so I said, man, let me call this dude back and see if he said this Sunday. Because maybe he said next Sunday. And I could hustle up a little bit of money or something. I don't know what I'm going to do, but let me just call him back. So I call him back. Steve, this is Chuck Sutton, Showtime at the Apollo. We saw a tape of yours. You're very, very funny. Look, we have an opening Sunday night at Showtime at the Apollo. If you can make it, we'd love to put you on TV. I said, it's this Sunday. Before I hit the button, I heard, doop, you have another message. Now, it wasn't there before. So I punched my code in. I listened to the second message. Says, Steve Harvey, this is Tom Sober from the Comedy Caravan. This is a Thursday. He said, I have a gig in Jacksonville, Florida on Friday night that pays $150. If you can get there Friday night, you'll make $150. So I called him back and I said, hey, Tom, did you get a gig away? He said, no, it's still available. He said, can you get there? I said, I'm in Pensacola, Florida. I'm 3.5 hours away. So I drive to Jacksonville, Florida, and that night I made the 150. The club owner said, man, you're funnier than the guy we hired. If you stay tomorrow night, I'm going to give you another $150. So now I got $300 now. So I get on the phone. I call Chuck Sutton. I say, hey, man, is the gig still available at Showtime at the Apollo? He said, yeah, we got one opening left. I said, I'll be there. So I called Eastern Airlines, who used to be open back then. They had a special for $99 going from Jacksonville, Florida to New York round trip. So I parked my car at the airport. I got it. Yeah. Got on plane, flew. Everything I had was in two bags. Got to the Apollo. I said, hey, man, I'm here. I got there at 11 o'clock in the morning. He said, you can't stay here because you don't come on to the late show tonight. I said, man, I ain't got nowhere to go. I said, if you just let me stay in this building, man, I ain't going to move around nothing. I ain't got nowhere to go. I'm in Harlem. I can't go back out here. I got these two bags. I got victim wrote all over me, man. So he said, all right, if you go upstairs, don't come down. So he put me in the dressing room on the sixth floor. So that's where all the comedians were. So I stayed up there. I got hungry around 3 o'clock, man. I couldn't take it no more. So I went back downstairs, a dude named Alton Liston. I said, hey, man. He said, man, I thought I told you don't come down them damn steps. I said, hey, man, I'm just hungry, man. I said, let me go to that KFC I saw in the corner. Just let me get some chicken. I'll come right back. He said, man, if you ain't back in 20 minutes, you ain't getting in this building. So I went, bought me some chicken, came back. So the comedians started coming in the building. They started coming up on the sixth floor. So I meet this guy named D.L. Hughley. I introduce myself. He introduced himself. I'm sitting there. Another guy come in named Dwayne Johnson. Then this other dude walked in named Jamie Foxx. And I introduced myself. We don't know each other. Ain't none of us famous. It's 1991, man. They gave everybody the lineup. I was on the last show of the night. I don't go on to 11 at night. I done had this four pieces of chicken. I'm starving, man. That chicken done wore off. I'm nervous, man. I'm about to throw up. D.L. Hughley went downstairs. D.L. Hughley got booed off. Dwayne Johnson got booed off. Jamie Foxx went down there and got booed. They booed Jamie, then Jamie started singing. And then they started clapping. And Jamie had their ass, then he went back to them jokes, and they got his ass. So I'm walking down the steps, and I see Jamie sitting on the steps. I said, hey, man, hang in there. He said, man, that ain't never happened to me before, man. This is crazy. This Jamie Foxx, man, one of the most talented people in all of comedy. And now, you don't even know how nervous I am, man. I can't even. My breathing is shot because these dudes been booed. So I walk out. I had wrote this joke. Mike Tyson had got in a fight in Harlem with this heavyweight named Mitch Green. Mike Tyson had hit the dude in the eye in the store. Now, he was on the news. His eye was swollen. So the joke I wrote was they was interviewing Mitch Green, and he was telling everybody what happened, but his eye took over the interview. And I wrote this joke that his eye started talking and was just, I tell you what happened. The heavyweight champ's fist is coming towards my face. I just said, Lord, Lord, Lord. And I wrote this whole joke about this dude's eyeball talking. And when the punch came, and all this here, the Apollo, man, they went crazy. They lost their mind. I got a standing ovation, man. I walked off stage, man, just started crying. I couldn't believe it. They paid me. I made $750 for being on TV for one night. I'd never made $750 telling jokes in one night. And so that was my first television appearance. A couple weeks later, Sinbad was the host of the show. He got this job on Different World. And so he quit. And so Mark Curry became the host. And then Mark Curry got hanging with Mr. Cooper, and he quit. And they came to me and said, would you come back to New York and host Amateur Night for us to just try you out? Oh, ain't no problem. And so I went to New York. I hosted Amateur Night, and I was killing. But every time it went to commercial break, I was supposed to let the warm-up act take over like Ruben does. But I knew not to let the warm-up act do that because he would change the attitude of the crowd because Apollo was a wild place. So I stayed out there. I did the warm-up and the hosting. And I created a bond with that audience. And that's how I got on TV. It was my very first TV show. I hosted Showtime at the Apollo. I ended up being the longest running host in the history of Showtime. I did that show for 8 years. Nobody ever did it for 8 years. And that was my turn back moment. See, in your life, everybody has a turn back moment. You have a moment where you can go forward or you can give up. But the thing you have to keep in mind before you give up is that if you give up, the guarantee is it will never happen. That's the guarantee of quitting, that it will never happen, no way under the sun. The only way the possibility remains that it can happen is if you never give up no matter what. Because God is always coming. He's never too late. At your worst moment, look, man, when they told me I had to be in New York, I saw no way I could get there. But that God, though, he make the phone ring. I end up in Florida. I make $300. Then I go to New York. I make $750. Almost got $1,000 out of nowhere. That's what happened to me. That was my moment of never giving up. That's when I first learned that faith was everything, that you have to remain faithful.
Okay, I had to get back to my studio here. All right, today we got trending topics open, you know, it's open for anything you guys want to talk about. I'm going to start off with, I'm going to pick on reparations as a start off. And in my opinion, I think that black folks in the United States that want reparations and some are fighting for reparations isn't an efficient use of their time. And here's what I'm putting out here. I'm using the billionaire barometer, what I call the billionaire barometer. And here's some statistics, which I got offline. Globally, there are 2,755 billionaires on the planet. Once again, and that's not a whole lot out of, you know, about 8 billion people on the planet. But there are 2,755 billionaires on the planet Earth. And only 15, let's get a little bit deeper in this. Now, this is United States specific, what I'm about to read. And this comes from Forbes magazine. There are a record number of immigrants have become billionaires in the United States. All right. 92 immigrants hailing from 35 countries have become billionaires in the United States. From Zoom founder and CEO Eric Yuen, set his sights on the United States as a recent college graduate in the 1990s, he was denied a visa 8 times in 18 months. Determined to join his idols like Bill Gates, making it big in tech, the son of mining engineers in China's eastern Shandong province, refused to take no for an answer. I told myself, okay, great. I'll do all I can until you tell me that I can never come in here, never again, you told Forbes magazine in 2019. Otherwise, I'm not going to stop. Yoon's persistence paid off. He finally got a visa and headed to California in the summer of 1997 to join WebEx as an early employee. 2 decades later, the rival video communications company he ended up founding and running has fundamentally changed the way we connect with each other in the midst of a global pandemic. Yoon, who's worth an estimated $5.2 billion as of March 11th, the date Forbes used to measure net worths in the latest billionaires list, is just one of 92 foreign-born American citizens on Forbes' annual World's Billionaire list for 2022, who currently lives in the United States. You heard right, 13% of the list of 735 Americans are immigrants. Billionaires here in the United States, they weren't born here, and only 15 billionaires globally. So when you narrow it down, that's globally 15 black billionaires, and most of those are in Africa. But that's the barometer I'm using, because I've never seen or heard of somebody becoming a millionaire off of a reparations check. There's no such thing as a reparations millionaire. There's no such thing as a reparations billionaire. At least not yet. It might be one day. But for right now, there isn't. So these 92 people that came in, and, oh, before I go into that, now we do have some black billionaires in this country. Jay-Z, Dre, I think Rihanna, who's from Barbados, she's a billionaire. And there's some others. And the common denominator of the black American billionaires is, and matter of fact, let me throw this out there. In my study of billionaires, I found the primary common denominator is billionaires are typically pioneers. Number two, when you're a pioneer, you're in an industry where there's very little or absolutely zero government regulation. That's the common denominator that I've noticed among the majority of billionaires. There's some exceptions, but overall, that's what I found to be true. They're pioneers. Now, there's some cases where they're not pioneers. Like he's passed over now. This guy DeLuca, the guy who founded Subway sandwiches. Okay, the sub sandwich. When he put together his first Subway business, sandwich shop, you know, sandwiches are nothing new. And people have been making sandwiches forever around the world. But the thing is, to open up a sandwich shop, well, first thing, just to make a sandwich, for the most part, you don't need a business license to make a sandwich. You don't need a four-year degree to make a sandwich. Okay? You don't have to go to business school or Harvard Business School or Yale. And you don't have to go to any of those schools and get an MBA in finance to make a sandwich. Okay? A five-year-old, a four-year-old can make a sandwich, all right? So essentially, making sandwiches is required. There's no regulation. Now, of course, if you open up a shop, a sandwich shop, you know, you might have to get a business license, and the health inspector comes through and makes sure that everything is clean and sanitary. But outside of that, the technical skills, there's no license required to actually make a sandwich. Okay, so DeLuca was, I mean, before he passed on, he was a billionaire by making submarine sandwiches. Okay. No cost required, no business license required to actually make a sub sandwich. There's another guy, Kavanaugh. He started, I think, Janet King. You know, people who want to start their own cleaning business. You know, you don't need a bachelor's degree. You don't need a GED. Okay, you don't need a high school diploma to clean toilets. All right, to clean offices, to clean homes. And he put something together with his Johnny King things, you know, creating business opportunities for people that wanted to get into the cleaning business or household services business or environmental services, what do you want to call it today. And he became a billionaire. All right. Dr. Dre, headphones. Okay. That's how, you know, that's one of the things that he got to where he's got to. And in hip-hop, you know, because Dr. Dre's part of the hip-hop scene, and Jay-Z's part of that also, and Puff Daddy's part of that. No license required. Now, if you open up a brick-and-mortar place in California or New York or whatever, you know, you can get a business license, but you're not regulated out of the yin-yang for any of those. Berry Gordy, who's still around, you know, when he started Motown Records, he didn't need a business license for that, you know, to make records, to do concerts and whatnot. So, like I say, in my study of billionaires, I mean, Mark Zuckerberg with Facebook. Facebook is nothing but a glorified website. You know, the register, the domain name, today might be $2 or $5 or whatever it might be, you know, but to register a domain name is relatively simple and easy and super inexpensive. And, you know, he built it out and he became a billionaire in his mid-20s. Bill Gates, when he started, you know, it was, the internet and all the industries that are connected to it, to a very high degree, it's the Wild West even now. In 2022, going into 2023, little or no government regulation. And in an environment of little or no government regulation, you can do what they want to do. And while I'm thinking about it, if we go back to slaves, the time when slavery was legal in the United States, you know, prior to 1776, okay, there was no governmental agency on the law. First thing, governmental agencies as we know them today did not exist. So when you're in an environment where you have no watchdog organization, such as a government agency, anything goes. And that includes human trafficking, also known as slavery. So prior to 1776, and even after 1776, because the political process does run slow, okay, between 1776, well, hold, let's do the arithmetic on this. So slavery was abolished in, 1863? All right, let's take it back to 1776. So on July 4, 1776, there was no such thing as slavery being illegal because there was no government in place to do that. Now, when they formed, it put it this way, from 1776 to 1863, that's, hold on, did I do this right? Oh, all right. Oh, I did it wrong. All right. 1863. From 1776 to 1863, that's 87 years. 87 years it took to say, all right, let's outlaw slavery. So for 87 years, it was wide open. That's slang talk, but it was wide open. You can do what you want to do. You can set up a business and hire who you wanted to hire or do what you wanted to do. But, you know, there was no such thing as code enforcement. You know, a lot of agencies that exist today didn't exist then. So when a lot of these immigrants come to this country, they're looking at, they're seeing opportunities that we don't see, that a typical American might not see. Just like if you go to their country, you'll probably see opportunities that the locals don't see. But anyway, let me bring this back to why I think reparations, although you have people very adamant about, I think it's basically a waste of time, because using the billionaire barometer, okay, number one, I've never seen a person or heard of one. Let me know if you know of some, let me know. I've never heard of anybody becoming a millionaire from reparations on an individual basis. Number two, because, matter of fact, Japanese Americans who got reparations from the Civil Liberties Act of 1988, which Ronald Reagan sent, they got reparations checks of maybe about 22,000 to 25,000 tops. That was it. That was it. Show me a reparations billionaire. That's the barometer I'm using. Now, Jay-Z, Dr. Dre, Rihanna, Bob Johnson, Michael Jordan, I understand LeBron James now. These are all black billionaires, first generation. And not a single one of them got a check from the government. Not a single one. So using the billionaire barometer, I think, matter of fact, because there are busloads of immigrants that have been entering the United States all this year. About 3 or 4 weeks ago, I announced that Washington, D.C., between April and August of this, or fall of this year, 9,000 have been bused into Washington, D.C. You got them coming from Florida all the way up to Massachusetts. You got them coming in from the south of the border in Mexico on up to Chicago and then around the Chicagoland area in the suburbs. And they're going to different destinations within the United States. I just named three. And here's some of the barometers. I have a talk with a gentleman up in Chicago. And he, Monday through Friday, he takes his walk to McDonald's right in his neighborhood. And some days, particularly after payday, and this is a McDonald's in a black neighborhood where they were hiring black folk, the lobby isn't open because not enough people showed up for work. So you had to go to the drive-thru. Within the next year or so, definitely in less than 24 months, I predict that McDonald's lobby will be open for breakfast every day, 7 days a week, 365 days out of the year. Because the immigrants that have come to the Chicagoland area will be filling those positions for jobs. Nobody's going to be taking anybody's job How can you take somebody's job if you refuse to work there? But that's going to go on all around the United States. Where you don't work, somebody else will. On the same note, you're going to have immigrants. There are immigrants that have come in to step into the country today. What's today's date? October the 13th, 2022. Within the next 5 to 10 years or less, there'll be additional, I'm going to say at least 100, and I'm glad we record all these shows, there'll be at least 100 new immigrants who become millionaires and a handful become billionaires. They're not going to the government for help. And they're seizing opportunities. That's why I play that Nine Friends audio so much. Here's a house sitting in, you know, sitting in the neighborhood that all the neighbors ignored it. Probably had some neighbors that called code enforcement on people and all that. But then the guy and his nine friends who are immigrants, they get that house and made it look brand new in a matter of hours. Less than a day. I will put this out here, too. You do have people like the ones that are doing the Freedom Georgia Initiative. I like what they're doing. And there are other groups like that as well. But the people from the Freedom Georgia Initiative, that now they're at 502 acres, not a penny of that money came from the government. They didn't wait for the government to give them their 40 acres. And they definitely didn't wait on a reparations check. So you do have, hopefully, there'll be more groups like the Freedom Georgia Initiative, and there'll be more outside of entertainment. You'll have more black entrepreneurs that, and you do have them, but I'm just saying, in my opinion, it's a more efficient use of your time to look for opportunities that you're standing right in the middle of right now. God knows. You do have, well, the number of black billionaires, I believe, will grow. It'll grow. And I don't know what the numbers are for people who want reparations or whatever, but I'm just saying, I think it's just a more efficient use of time. If you look into something that has little or no government regulation, because to get reparations it requires an act of Congress. And that's a very slow and expensive project. No process, rather. And I'm from the Booker T. Washington School of Thought. Okay, get your billions first and get a collective of you. And when you got 100 Jay-Z's, that's not even enough. When you got 1,000 Jay-Z's or 1,000 Dr. Dre's or 1,000 Berry Gordy's, okay, or 1,000 Oprahs out here, then let's say maybe 10% of that, 100, you got the money to bankroll legislation, and then do it that way. Get your money right first. Well, Scarface said the best in the movie Scarface. three basic rules, but only two apply for this particular situation. All right. Scarface said, in this country, and he was speaking of the United States, there's a character, Scarface, was from Cuba, and he was a Cuban immigrant, played by Al Pacino. In this country, you have to get the money first. Claude Anderson says the same thing. Get your businesses and industries first. Booker T. Washington said the same thing. Get your industry down first. Second, after you get your money, then you get the power. That's where the politics come in at. And then, of course, Scarface said women, but let's just, for the sake of this discussion, let's just get your money first, get your power second. The reparations crowd is trying to get the power first, and you need money to get the power that you need. Political power. The Bible, as Claude Anderson says, to buy and or lease your power, you got to have your businesses and your industries under control. Name an industry. Now, you know what? One industry that if we can ever organize it, because there's a lot of money and a lot of people in the black church. Imagine if you turn that into a self-regulated industry. If that can never organize, I think you would have a real good at reparations now. But, however, it's fractured. You know, it's a bunch of lone wolves. T.G. Jakes does his own thing. Crenshaw Christian Center, they do their own thing. West Angeles Church does their own thing. Creflo Dollar does his own thing ad infinitum. Think if just two of those entities got together, just two. Anyway, but, all right, that's my rant on getting to something that has little or no government regulation, if you're looking for something to get into. All right, let's see. All right, read more of this article. These immigrants hail from 30 different countries in every continent except for Antarctica. The world's richest person, Elon Musk of Tesla and SpaceX, is one of three from South Africa. The other five hail from elsewhere in Africa, including Tope Wantua, 1.4 billion, the founder of and CEO of software company Candlely. That's a 12-year-old in Lagos, Nigeria. And Antona witnessed his father get shot and killed in a carjacking. 3 years later, he and his family moved to Atlanta, Georgia. Now, let me read more about this dude. Okay. Okay, let me see. Now, this cat, Tope, T-O-P-E, A-W-O-T-O-N-A, and Tortona. Now, let's read more about him. Now, this is a black billionaire out of Africa. Okay, let's get the 411 on him. Okay, I don't see his Wikipedia. All right, well, let's get what Forbes has to say about him. All right, Tope, T-O-P-E, at Watona, A-W-O-T-O-N-A. Let's see, net worth $1.4 billion. Topi is the founder and CEO of the scheduling software company Candly. I gotta pronounce his name. Awotona, a former salesman for sales tech, including EMC, now Dell EMC, founded Candly out of his own frustration with the back and forth emails required to schedule meetings. Emails are not regulated. He bootstrapped Candly for years by taking on a $350 million investment in 2021 that valued the firm at $3 billion. Born in Lagos, Nigeria, I'm going to call him Topi. Topi immigrated to the United States as a teenager. Before founding Candly, he had started a few other businesses, including one that sold projectors and another one that sold garden tools that flopped. No, he's persistent. This is a man, black man, originally from Lagos, Nigeria. He has come to this country, the United States, and he didn't get on that government, he didn't get on the government gravy train and became a billionaire. Black man. All right, that's my rant on that. We can talk about anything you guys want to talk about. I got to find my studio again. Let's see. All right. I'm just waiting for my studio to repopulate on my phone. Okay. All right. Well, I'm looking at actually these immigrants are coming in this country and they're recognizing opportunities that are available, just like this guy Topi out of Nigeria. He comes to this country and he sees opportunities that the average American doesn't see. And now he's a billionaire. And he's a black billionaire. So I think there's some, you know what, I don't know the guy personally, but I'm guessing he's not coming because a lot of limitations that people have, and this is people of all ages and races and whatever, more than likely, I bet you this guy has not bought into the concept of white supremacy. He didn't buy into it. He just looked at, you know what, here's a place where I can make it big. Well, I could just make it. He comes over to this country and he's a billionaire. You know, Elon Musk, you know, no limitation. You can see, man, this is a place where there's less regulation. And the industries that he can get into that are, you know, there's no agency to sub and say you can't do this. So there's a lot of opportunity that's out here. We just have to see it. For, you know what, and that's for those who want to see it. Okay, well, let's see. Anyway, those are my rants for today. I'm going to play Nine Friends. I'm going to rename this to Nine Immigrant Friends.
Since 2007, more than 50% of the world...
Oh, wrong one.
I say some shit to y'all that I seen yesterday that made me smile, but it hurt me to my heart. There's a house next door to me that's been abandoned, and the yard, the grass, high as hell and everything. There's a couple of abandoned cars out there beside the house. Well, yesterday I get off work about 7 o'clock. A Mexican guy pulled up. He said, "These your cars?" I said, "No." He said, "I just bought this house, man." I said, "All right, that's what's up." He was like, "You know whose cars it is?" He said, "No." He said, "Well, I bought the house, not the cars." Okay, I'm like, cool. I'm thinking he's just coming to look at the house. I go back in the house, do a little straighten up. I swear to God, I walk back at the house. Now, I'm getting off about 7:20. It's fucking 9 Mexican trucks just pulled up. They got fucking beer, lights, and shit, right? So I'm like, what y'all finna do? He said, "We finna fix this house." I said, "What kind of crew you got working after 7 o'clock? He said, "These my friends." The fucking house is fixed this morning. They went in there and drywalled that fucking house. Wow. I just left out of there. It was a fucking abandoned house. That bitch looked new this morning. Whew. It was an abandoned fucking house, and it looked new this morning. It's an old African proverb: many hands make light work. I just don't think they're better than us. I just think we won't do nothing together. Wow. You're not hearing what the fuck I'm saying. It was an abandoned house yesterday at 7:15. That bitch is new this morning. He bought a tax lien house. I can't wait to see what they do. I can't wait to see, is one family gonna live in there? Is they gonna, I'm going to get to know the motherfuckers. You best believe me, when I make some money, I'm gonna do it. I'm gonna bring us together. And I'm not fucking with a lot of people.
Can you do it when you keep trying to rip me off? How in the world can you call me brother when we can't even have that's all my tide is gone. I opened up the door, yeah, and there was my glove compartment all torn out on my dashboard. And here you come, here you come, here you come again, and grinning, yeah. The power sign and talking about my man, solid on that, my brother. I said I don't like, how can you really mean it? I know about you, I know what you're good for, I know what you're doing around here, I know all about you, I know all about, I know you're my fighter, my seven, low down, deep, right, no good, son of a seeker, yeah. I know you're dirty. That kind of can on, I don't buy. Giving me the old bad handshake, don't do it. I can't use it, no. Selling me right on. Ain't no good.
Back in the year 1843, a man was born who, during his lifetime, was to have a profound effect on literally millions of people. His name was Russell Herman Conwell. He became a lawyer, then a newspaper editor, and finally a clergyman in 1881. It was during this latter period that an incident occurred which was to change his life and the lives of countless others. One day a group of boys came to Dr. Conwell at his church and asked him if he would be willing to instruct them in college courses. They wanted a college education, but lacked the money to attend. He told them he'd do all he could, and as the boys left, a thought, an idea began forming in Dr. Conwell's mind. He asked himself, why couldn't there be a fine college for poor but deserving young men? Here was a great idea, and he went to work on it at once. Almost single-handedly, Dr. Conwell raised between $6 and $8 million with which he founded the now well-known Temple University of Philadelphia. It was how he raised this money that I want to tell you about. He raised the money by giving lectures all over the country, more than 6,000 of them, and in each he told a story called Acres of Diamonds. This was a true story which had affected him very deeply, just as it affected his audiences. It was the story of a farmer who had settled in Africa. This farmer had heard the exciting stories of other African settlers who had made millions by discovering diamond mines. Realizing the African continent was rich in diamonds, the farmer could hardly wait to sell his farm and search for diamonds himself. He spent the rest of his life wandering the vast African continent, searching for the gleaming gems which brought such high prices on the markets of the world, but without success. Finally, in a sudden fit of despondency, broke and desperate, as I remember the story, he threw himself into a river and drowned. During this time, the man who had bought his farm one day found a large and unusual stone in the stream which cut through the property. It turned out to be a great diamond of enormous value, and then he discovered that his farm was covered with them. It was to become one of the world's richest diamond mines. Now, the first farmer had owned literally acres of diamonds, but had sold them for practically nothing in order to look for them elsewhere. If he had only taken the time and study to know what diamonds looked like in their rough state, and had first thoroughly explored the land he had owned, he would have had the millions he sought, right on the land he had been living upon. What so profoundly affected Dr. Conwell and subsequently thousands of others was the obvious fact that each of us is, at this moment, standing in the middle of his own acres of diamonds. If we will only have the wisdom and patience to intelligently and effectively explore the work in which we are now engaged, we will usually find that it contains the riches we seek, whether they be financial or intangible or both. Before we go running off to what we think are greener pastures, let's make sure that our own is not just as green, or perhaps even greener. While we're looking at other pastures, other people are looking at ours. There's nothing more pitiful to my mind than the person who wastes his life running from one thing to another, like the first farmer, forever looking for the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, and never staying with one thing long enough to find it. For no matter what your goal may be, the road to it can be found somewhere in the work in which you now find yourself. It wasn't until he was completely paralyzed, for example, and was forced to reach into the resources of his mind, that a Wisconsin farmer got the idea of producing exceptionally good meat products on his farm, and one of the country's largest meatpacking companies was born. His farm contained acres of diamonds, too. He had just never seen them before. A paper salesman found a dirty drinking glass in his hotel room and gave his company the idea of manufacturing paper cups, an idea that solved his financial problems for life. An insurance man got the idea of going back to all the people in his files and really working with them, serving them the way they should be served. That year, he wrote an additional $700,000 of insurance, made the million-dollar round table, and found he no longer had to approach cold prospects, that by working with the people he had already sold and on their referrals, he had acres of diamonds right in his filing cabinet. A man out west amassed a fortune with a single small gas station. In the beginning, when things were tough, he would ask himself each morning, "What can I do to increase my service to my customers?" He still asks that question of himself each morning when he gets up, and while he could have retired years ago a wealthy man, he continues to dominate the business in his area by thinking of new and better ways to be of service. Do you know what the so-called average man would have done in this last case? He would have been worried about how bad business was, because in the beginning my friend had a hard time just feeding his family. When one day a man would have driven in the station in a big shiny car, this average man, seeing the wealthy customer, would have said to himself, "I ought to be in his business instead of mine." You see, the average man believes some businesses are better than others, instead of realizing the truth that there are no bad businesses. There are just those people who do not know enough to see the opportunities in the work they're in. Jobs don't have futures. People do. No matter what our work happens to be, it's our business. We're its manager. If we can see no future or opportunity in it, it isn't because it's not there, but only because we can't see it. One time another farmer poked a tiny pumpkin into an empty 1 gallon jug. The pumpkin grew until it completely filled the jug and could grow no more. When it was ripe, the farmer broke the glass jug and had a pumpkin which had assumed the jug's exact shape. In life, each of us does a similar thing. We poke ourselves into jugs of our own deciding, and we can grow no larger. But let's be mature enough to realize that it is we who do the poking, not the job, nor the company, nor the territory, nor the economy, nor the times. We do it. We should dispense with limitations and realize there is virtually no limit to our growth and development on the land on which we now find ourselves. Above all, keep this thought in mind as often as you can on and off the job. Somewhere within the work you are now doing, there lurks an opportunity which will bring you everything you could possibly want for yourself and your family. In closing, here are 12 points to remember. 1. If we will develop the wisdom and patience to intelligently and effectively explore the work in which we are now engaged, we will find it contains the riches, tangible and intangible, we seek. 2. Before we go running off to what we think are greener pastures, let's realize our own pasture is unlimited. 3. That there are no bad jobs, but that it's the way in which we go about our work which makes it good or bad. 4. That we poke ourselves into jugs beyond which we cannot grow. Let's remove the limitations we've set upon ourselves. 5. That only preparation can ensure our taking advantage of the opportunities which will present themselves in the future, opportunities which are around us now. 6. Put your imagination to work on the many ways and means of improving what you're now doing. 7. Learn all you can about your job, your company, and your industry. 8. Since there's no limit to the growth of your industry, it must follow there is similarly no limit on your growth potential within that industry. 9. Our dynamic and growing economy needs and will well reward the uncommon man who seeks a place in this growth. 10. Begin to build your library of reference material pertaining to your company, industry, job, and on how to better serve and get along with people. 11. Set aside an hour a day for this study and research. And 12. Remember the story of the Acres of Diamonds. Zerl Nightingale, thank you.
Okay, I have to wait for my phone to reboot. Well, I agree with Earl Nightingale. All of us are standing in our own middle of our own acre of diamonds. We just have to take time to recognize it. Typically, one of those diamonds is a problem. If you're facing any type of problem or challenge, just sit down and reframe it, and that can be your acres of diamonds right there. That problem that you're facing is really an opportunity that is misunderstood by you at the time. Let's see. All right, well, that's all I got for you guys today, unless you guys want to throw up anything. It is 11:58 a.m. here where I'm at. And let's see. I'm just looking in my library here. Oh, let's see. We do have a caller here. 410, your mic is open.
Who's that, Brother L.A.? How are you?
I'm fine.
I'm doing fantastic. I'm amongst the land of the living.
Well, that's the most important thing, among the living.
Yeah, that's the ultimate blessing. Everything else is secondary and can be handled. Where's the crowd at today?
Right. Quiet day today, I guess, Thursday, which some people call Junior Friday. You're quiet today. Anyway. But, yeah, no, go ahead. I'm listening.
No, go ahead.
No, I was saying I haven't heard anything. I heard something, Candace Owens. Candace Owens, I think she's done a documentary or about to do something where she's exposing Black Lives Matter. But I've only seen a trailer so far. I don't know if she's released it or will release it. Well, she will release it, but, and I hadn't heard anything from her in a while as well, so. Be interesting when she has what her documentary says about Black Lives Matter, the organization.
Candace Owens is in trouble. I saw that this morning. You know, her and Kanye West was, promoting White Lives Matter T-shirts. Kanye West is a mad genius. I got to give it to him. You know, the boy's insane, but he's a master marketer.
He is that.
And he says something about the Jews, and Candace Owens is associated with him, and all of your Fox News friends, they were just giving praise and Kanye West to high heavens, but he said that thing about the Jews. Now all of your white and black conservatives is backpedaling away from him, as usual. And she went on this year, hey, look, wait a minute. I ain't with Kanye West on this one now. Hold it. I can only go so far. So, you know, hey, people know when they stepped over the line,
right,
with some people. But when it comes to us black folks, they just they just step over the line and kick us in the groin, or either hit us below the belt when they say certain things about certain people. All of a sudden, they start apologizing, which, you know, it couldn't happen to a better person than Candace Owens. Mm. And her white liberal friends are in trouble, too, because all on Fox News, everybody was just praising the graces and the accomplishments of Kanye West. But when he dropped that thing about the Jews, and Kanye is not backing down, and what he said was right. But the thing is, when you say certain things about certain people, you got to kiss the toe. And I found that quite interesting, so I don't know where her documentary is going to be.
Yeah, I'm going to look it up. Probably watch it. I mean, I look at she. I saw one trailer. I don't know if it's going to be a documentary or it's going to be a, you know, a miniseries or whatever, but of course, when she's going to tell it from her point of view. And Candace Owens, now I was a Candace Owens fan, but on some things I don't agree with her with. Like with the George Floyd thing, I disagree with her on it. She believes that the jury got it wrong, her words, with the conviction of the cops that in the George Floyd case. And I disagree with her 1,000%. How could you say the jury got that wrong? I mean, because it was, in my opinion, it was obvious that he killed the man. I don't, anyway, but that, Candace Owens, I think, she goes too far sometimes.
No, she doesn't go too far. Her handlers. No, her handlers puts the words in her mouth and gives her the talking points for her to use. Look, Candace Owens couldn't find her way out of a wet paper sack. Come on, you know Candace Owens ain't her bread ain't done, L.A. She's not that smart. That girl is getting a check, as you say. You know, she tried to work her ranks up in the Democratic Party. She couldn't get up there and make any money, you know, as a liberal. So what happened is a white boy convinced her to come over to the conservative side. And she hasn't looked back. She's got a little bit of money. She got a white husband. So, hey, when Candace Owens talk, I see a white guy putting a battery in her back. Just like all the other black conservatives out here on television and on radio. Because all they're doing is regurgitating white conservative talking points. I haven't seen one black conservative, and liberal for that matter, come out with an original thought. Have you?
I had to do my research on that when the jury's up.
Well, I tell you what. If you find one, call me. I'll give you a $100 C note. Call me.
Well,
you don't
motivation enough.
In fact, I might give you more than that. If you can find one, not one has come up with an original thought that they come up on their own, whether they're a writer or whether they're just a talking head. Not one. Now, you know, I'm putting a challenge out there. That's just like I sent you something this morning about that discussion we had yesterday. I don't know
right.
If you've seen it or not, but check it out.
Yeah. Excuse me, I scanned it this morning. I did scan it. I'll read it again without a scan.
Yeah.
But I think Candace Owens, I think what she's got a son now. I think Candace Owens, her points of view will be dramatically changed when her son is about 16, 17 years old.
Well, let me give you this. Has Alan West's opinions changed? He has children. At Larry
you
Jordan
know what?
Doesn't have any.
Larry Elder hasn't. And he's been kind of quiet lately, too.
Well, yeah, since that white girl put him up on charges for what? Battering and abuse and pulling a gun out on her? No, he's been real quiet because the white conservatives kind of cooled down on his behind, too, you know. He was beating up that white girl that he was supposed to be married to or going with. So,
okay.
Yeah, he's been real quiet. But the trick is, there's a whole lot of black conservatives out there that's got children. And the thing is, hey, they march to the beat of that drum, too. But look, when you find that you got to pay your mortgage, make your car payment, and keep the water and the lights on,
right,
you'll sell your soul to the devil when you can't figure out any other way to make a living. And, you know, some people take great pride in being an honorary white boy or white girl. And that goes for the liberal side, too.
Right.
You know, it's hard out here, Brother L.A., when you can find a way to make a living, and especially with you down in black folk. I mean, hey, the money's just too good. You know, do you think Jesse Lee Peterson would have a radio show if he was just a regular black person? He ain't got the talent. But see, those conservatives pay him good money, and they contribute to his foundation. In fact, he said it. He said as long as white folks keep contributing to his foundation, hey, he's going to talk nasty about black folks every chance he gets.
Right.
So, you know, hey, when you sell out, you don't have morals. But anyway, look, how many do you believe in affirmative action?
Ooh, that's a good question. That's a very good question.
No, I mean, you should be able to come right off the top of your head with whether you agree with it or not. I don't hesitate when somebody asks me that. And you don't have to be politically correct when you give me an answer.
I want to say no.
Why?
Because I believe if you are the best qualified for that position, and we do have to factor in any organization there's internal politics involved. But if you're the best or the most qualified for that position, more than likely you're going to get that job. Now, let me add this on, too. I don't believe that a business should be bullied into hiring somebody. I believe that a business should be able to, I don't know about government, but I think a private business should be allowed to hire whoever they want to hire, even if that person is not the best qualified at that time for that position. I believe a bit. Because I can hire somebody that has no experience, and I can train them. But I'm not a fan of affirmative action. That's me.
Let me go back. Let me take a step back. What is your definition of affirmative action?
Well, whatever the government said, I had to look it up. I mean, hold it. All right, just off the top of my head without looking up anything, my interpretation of affirmative action is hiring somebody of a minority status that normally would not get a chance to get that position. Now, with that said, I don't know what the tax laws on this are right now, but at one time, as a business owner, it was more beneficial to hire a black woman or Asian woman to fill a position, even if she wasn't the most qualified technically speaking. Why? Because if I hire a woman, women are elite. I don't know how the tax laws now, but 25, 30 years ago, a woman was classified as a minority. So if I hire a woman, even a white woman, I get a tax deduction for that. If I hire a double minority, be she a woman and black, or a woman and Asian, or a woman and Native American, I get a double tax credit for hiring them. So it would be beneficial for me as a business owner to hire a black woman, a black Asian woman, a black Latino woman, or a black Native American woman over any man, regardless of color.
Let me simplify it. My definition is getting something that you don't qualify for.
All right, that's probably more accurate.
Okay, now look, let me give you this one. Those immigrants that came over here in the 1800s that wasn't even citizens and got 160 acres of land under the Homestead Act and the Southern Homestead Act that weren't citizens, did they qualify to get that land free from the government?
Well, they got it, so.
No, answer my question. Answer my question now.
Oh, repeat that question again.
Yeah, well, you heard it. You and I agree that affirmative action getting something that you don't qualify for.
Right. That's under a job description, yeah.
No, that's in anything. Affirmative action don't necessarily have to pertain to the job.
So you're saying that the foreigners, that the immigrants that came over and got the land
for free.
Well, to that I say there's something out here for everybody.
No, because answer my question. Yes or no? We agree that, hey, look, affirmative action is getting something you don't qualify for.
Right.
So, was that affirmative action or wasn't it?
I guess you can call it that.
I know you can call it that. They got 160 acres of land that was a government program for citizens. And they were invited over here by the government and given that land over there in the Midwest for free.
Right.
Now, you can have an argument that, hey, slaves at that particular time weren't citizens either, were they? They were 3/5 of a man.
Right.
But they couldn't get it. And after they became citizens, they couldn't get it. So now, the thing is this, America has always been an affirmative action program for white folk. White males and white women have always gotten jobs that they didn't qualify for. So now, affirmative action really is the foundation of America. Now, give me your spiel on that.
There have been other immigrants that are their government, and I got to get the facts on this. There are government programs, set aside programs for a whole lot of people around this country, handicapped people, blind people. You name it. There's some type of program for everybody out here.
They qualify for it. They have a disability.
Yeah.
But now I gave you I asked you a question about some people that didn't qualify for a program that got the benefits of that program that weren't citizens. I don't over here. So now, and look, you can go all over in this history of America where white folks didn't qualify for a position, and look, rightfully so, because I'm like you. I don't believe in forcing a private business to hire somebody because of their race, creed, color, sexual preference, or religion. But now right. I do say this here. I believe that blacks should have an equal opportunity for government jobs and municipality jobs because our tax dollars fund those. That's where I stand. But now the thing is, you got a bunch of people out here, both white and black, that is against anything to help a black person. And affirmative action was just to go ahead on and make sure that, hey, look, you're competing for a position, you got equal qualifications, but the lesser person, the person with the lesser qualifications don't get that job. Now, I work for the government. And the thing is, affirmative action was wrongly described and lied on to say that, you know, black folks could get it over a white person who was more qualified. That's not true.
Right.
In the United States Federal Service, it was, hey, look, if I go golfing with you and I'm white, I'm going to look out for you, whether you qualify or not. But
right.
affirmative action is that if you hire a person with less qualifications than a woman or a minority, then you have to justify why you picked that lesser qualified person over a better qualified person. That's
right.
what affirmative action is. So, but the thing is, same thing about reparations. The Holocaust never happened on these shores. And
no,
look, you can call me a Semite all you want to. I don't give a damn. But since 1945, the United States have been giving Israel $146 billion. But they ain't got no money when we talk about reparations. They're pumping money into Afghanistan now. But they ain't got no money for reparations. When those bankers in 2008 needed some money, they gave those bankers $6 trillion, and they said, hey, what's his name, Hank Paulson? So you can't ask me what I'm going to do with it, and you can't ask me when I'm going to pay it back. No questions asked.
Right.
But we have people in the peanut gallery saying that, hey, look, you know what? Black folks are waiting for a check. And the thing is, they're waiting. They're dependent on the government. Who depends on the government more than white folk?
Yeah.
I just want to know. Bankers don't need no money, but they got $6 trillion. When you subsidize a certain industry in this country, that's corporate welfare, isn't it?
Some would say that, yes.
No, no, what do you say?
I don't know if I would want to use the word corporate welfare.
Huh?
I don't know if I want to use the word welfare for corporations.
Why not?
But I know what people mean by it.
No, no, but why would you use welfare when a corporation is subsidized? When it's for the benefit of shareholders and their CEOs. And not for the American people. Don't get me wrong, they hire people. But the thing is,
yeah, exactly, they hire people.
But here's the thing. They can go on Wall Street and get that same money, either go to banks and borrow the money. Why would they depend on the government? So now, I'm just giving you how people can come up with all types of criticism when black folks complain about being unjustly treated. But when it comes to white folk, they're entitled. They're entitled with no criticism. Yeah. I'm just throwing that out there at you, you know, just to see where your mindset is, because look, white folks couldn't survive without the government. When they came up with the New Deal, black folks was excluded out of it. In fact, the only reason the New Deal was created was because them white folks was getting ready to tie this country up. I sent you those food riots and all everything else. They were marching and demonstrating on Washington about no jobs, no food, and everything else. But nobody said, well, you know, daddy go marching again. You know, hey, and protesting. And they were tearing up stuff. I sent you the information. But nobody criticized them. In fact, one of the main things about Social Security was those Southern Democrats said, look, we ain't going to vote for it if niggas can qualify for it. You have got to exclude them out of it because 90% of the black farm workers, were blacks were farm workers. They couldn't get Social Security. And the only reason Social Security was enacted was because those old white women that were widows on those farms were starving to death.
That they were.
So tell me, why is it such a bad thing for black folks to press for reparations?
Well, my position once again is it's time and efficiency. My school of thought is get like Booker T. Washington, get your industry, business and industries moneyed up first, and then when you got a critical mass of numbers, then you have the money to bankroll the system to get reparations. See, mine's a 1-2 step. So I'm looking at just like this guy that I was reading about from Lagos, Nigeria. He came over here, and now he's got a net worth of about $1.4 billion or whatever it is. And he saw opportunity right here in this country right now. Where, the biggest reparations checks, I mean, from that Japanese-American thing from when they had them in locked up over here, is it $22,000 to $25,000 checks. And that doesn't, that's 1988. So how long will that last? How long will a reparation check last?
That's not even an issue. And I'll tell you why. They got it. That's the main thing. With no protest, no criticism. So I don't care what the amount is. It's the act of decency and a moral obligation to go in and right a wrong. I don't give a damn if they only give black folks $1. What you're saying is...
Now, white folks today, is the United States government today responsible for acts that they did not commit?
They did commit acts.
I'm talking about the politicians who are sitting in the Congress and Senate today.
There's no statute of limitation on people that commit acts against human rights.
Let me ask you this. Do you feel like you deserve to get a reparations check?
Do I do what?
Do you feel that you're entitled to a reparations check?
Yes.
Okay. Now, next question is, in order to get reparations, you're going to have to prove that you have been hurt and harmed and in need of repair due to you being wronged. So with that in mind... Do you have any proof, forensic proof?
No.
How are we going to pay you a check?
No.
You can't prove
it? Hey, look, here's the thing. And look, let's be clear about this. There was an act against humanity here. My ancestors suffered that. And look, when they petitioned the federal government to correct the wrong through Kelly House, they put her in jail. She petitioned them right after the Civil War was over. So now the thing is, that petition was put in a long time ago. They didn't pay up. So, yes, I'm entitled to it. And look, as far as damage, all you got to do is just go across this United States and look at the condition black folks are in. And look, not only that, the lynching and the abuse and the laws through black codes that was enacted against black folk.
Well, in that case, let's take a lynching. Let's take a lynching. Okay. Now, that on a state level, that's murder. Murder is a state charge, not a federal charge, unless you kill somebody who works in the federal capacity. So, all right, let's go into court.
Be careful.
And
be
you
careful.
Would need, oh, let's go into court. Now, today you would need, a reparations investigator. You would also need a reparations attorney that can litigate your case. And you're going to need a forensic or reparations physician. Because
no, you don't.
You don't need a
forensic psychologist to come in with that. All you got to do is look at the condition of black people and look the things that happened during that time period. Now, look, have you ever heard of the Fugitive Slave Act?
I've heard of it. Yeah, I haven't read, but I've heard about it. Yeah.
Is it in the Constitution?
Well, we know you're not a fugitive slave.
Answer my question. You've heard of it, right?
Yeah, I've heard of it. Yeah, I have.
And it was enforced, right? Because it was a law.
It was.
Okay, then. So now all I'm saying is the United States, they supported it and enforced it. So now that thing you're talking, hey, look, you can dismiss that. I'm going to dismiss it if you don't. But the trick is this. In the Constitution, that three-fifths of a man was in there too. So with that being the case, these people, when they put it in the Constitution, as vague as they wrote it, it was to keep black folks in slavery. So with that being the case, no, I don't have to prove the damage. All you got to do is just look at the condition black folks are in. And when they did try to get up on their feet, all you got to do is look at what they did to the black farmers. They took 12 million acres of land through racist practices. So this thing that you come in with all of this other stuff out there, no, you can't. Hey, look, you have a ground to stand on, but it's very shaky ground. So you can't come across with that. And especially when they brought those people over here and gave them 160 acres of land or more that didn't have anything in the building of this country. We literally built this sucker from scratch. Now, I don't care what your boys say over there in St. Louis. You know and I know that this country wouldn't be the world economic power without slavery. That's proof enough right there.
Now, there were also white slaves. There was also Asian slaves.
I don't give a shit about them. I'm talking about black folks. Now, they can speak for themselves. I'm talking about our part. I don't care about them. They are not even part of my conversation. I'm just like the Jews. Hey, look, I'm speaking for my people, my Holocaust, my suffering. Now, if they want to talk about something over there, they can. But no, that's not germane to this conversation.
Well,
see, I ain't gonna let you go there. You know,
well,
I ain't gonna let you go there.
All right. Well, I'm gonna wrap it up for the day, Busy, because I'm too tired to fight. Okay.
Yeah, I done too tired you out, brother. Hey, look, I done peed in the corner, and I'm getting a TKO here. But look, I answered your questions about that school district thing with that text I sent you this morning, but. But, Brother L.A., look, don't try. when it comes to me. I was going to let you go today, but see, you had to bring up slavery. I mean, reparations. And you knew you were going to get a conversation for me, and I promised you I wasn't going
to. I brought it up in the context of, you know, you got these immigrants that are over here new, and I'm just saying, well, within 18 to 24 months, or within the next 4 to 5 years, we're going to be reading stories about so-and-so that came here during the pandemic and became wealthy. We're going to hear stories like that. And we're also going to hear about victim stories also. That's all I'm saying.
Brother L.A., the biggest success story in this country is black folk. We were released from slavery with nothing more than the shirt on our backs, and look where we are now. And look, every time we try to climb up, there always be something to tear it down, and we keep coming back. So now the thing, and look, let me give you this about this African immigrant. His butt wouldn't be over here if it weren't for the sacrifice we made in blood, sweat, and tears. He couldn't make it over there where he was from. So the opportunity that he got over here, guess what? We made it for him. So he doesn't have a ground to stand on. We battled the white boy so that he could get here. We thought that white boy died so that he could come over here, and anybody else that comes over here, Elon Musk and every damn body else. So now, hey, look, you can't whoop me with that stick. That's why they come here. So when a Nigerian, and look, he's not black. He's a Nigerian. You ask a Nigerian if they black or not.
That's true. Nigerians, they do not claim, they do not identify by skin tone.
And he's just as black as an ace of spades. But all I'm telling you is that you can't beat me with that stick. And look, every time somebody get in my face from a foreign country, black or white, see, I break their damn neck. Because the thing is, America wouldn't be America without the genius and the brawn of the black man here and the woman. Everything
and
that you enjoy in this country was created by us.
Throwing some brains with that. Throwing some brains with that, because we've done some smart things with inventions and all that as well.
Everything that's in America that's good, we created it. And I dare anybody to debate me on it or challenge me on it. You can't name one thing we enjoy today that black folks didn't create, even down to the toilet where you take a crap on.
We're going to end it on that one. Everybody have a good rest of the day.